Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Hundreds of wildlife experts and volunteers are working to rescue animals caught in the BP oil disaster. Birds, fish, sea turtles, marine mammals, and myriad other types of wildlife inhabit the Gulf Coast ecosystem. But there are many unknown factors that could affect their fate, such as how much more oil will pour into the Gulf, where it will wash ashore, and what the new hurricane season will bring. Joining me in the studio to talk about wildlife and the BP oil spill, David Mizajewski of the National Wildlife Federation and Jeremy Jackson of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Joining us by phone from Jackson, Mississippi, Tom Moorman of Ducks Unlimited. You can join us as well, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. David Mizajewski, I'd like to start with you. I know you've just returned from the Gulf. Give us the latest picture of the kinds and numbers of wildlife that have been found dead.
Well, the numbers continue to rise. There's every day a new report comes out with the latest casualties as far as wildlife goes. And looking at the numbers that came out yesterday, because they're published at noon, so they're not quite out yet, there's over 1,600 birds, over 900 of which are dead, that have been recovered. A lot of those are, pelicans. And on my trip down there, I did get to visit with the Fort Jackson Wildlife Rescue Facility, which is where the birds are being rehabilitated. And, it's tough to watch, I'll just say that. But there's over 500 turtles, again, the majority of those dead, 50 dolphins. There's a few alive, according to the latest report from yesterday. I don't know what the situation with those live ones are, but, if they've survived, over the last 24 hours or not. But generally speaking, it's kind of a nightmare vision. You go out on the water, you smell oil. It smells like you're in a gas station. And if you're out there long enough, it definitely affects your eyes, your breathing. If you get close enough to the thicker oil further out, you really need to be wearing a respirator. And while that's going on, you're watching dolphins swim through this dispersed oil. You're seeing sea turtles feeding on jellyfish that are bloated and floating on the surface with water. I personally watched flying fish, jump out of the cleaner water on one side of a current and land right in the middle of this, horizon to horizon slick of dispersed oil. As a wildlife lover, obviously that's heart-wrenching, but I think you don't even have to be a wildlife lover to just know that there's something really wrong with this situation.
How does this compare to the Exxon Valdez disaster?
Well, at this point, it's much worse in terms of the amount of oil that has spilled, the amount of sort of space that this oil is inhabiting at this time, at this point in time. I mean, one of the biggest things that I was struck with when I was in the Gulf was just how big it is. And, you go out and you ride around in a boat for an hour and you might not see, the oil. And then all of a sudden you come upon it. And then you realize that that's, again, a horizon to horizon slick of dispersed oil is just one of many. And, that was, what I saw was only about 25 miles offshore.
But now, weren't there even more dead wildlife in the Exxon Valdez?
Oh, yeah. In terms of the numbers, so far, there are fewer, individual animals that are being reported. But one of the keys here is, as I was just saying, the Gulf is so big, and the nature of the spill is very different than the Exxon spill. This is happening far offshore, 70 miles out, a mile deep. Exxon was much closer to shore. It wasn't so far away, and the effects were sort of immediate. It hit the shore, it hit the animals. It was this big, thick stuff. This is completely different because of the distance and because of the unprecedented amount of chemical dispersants that have been used on the oil.
And tell me why the numbers are so important.
Well, the numbers are important because Well, first and foremost, I think that can be a real, you know, kind of rallying call for people when they hear and see about animals dying. I mean, let's face it, we're emotional creatures, and that has an impact, and it can actually inspire people to get involved. But the key thing here is that even though the numbers that we're seeing might right now be lower than some other spills, we can't forget the fact that, quite honestly, these numbers are probably, you know, grossly, you know, smaller than the real number of animals that are dying immediately and that are going to be impacted in the long term because of the size of the spill, because of the fact that the use of dispersants, so much of the oil is now in rivers under the water where you can't see it. And so most people that are working on this would agree that the numbers of wildlife dying from this are probably exponentially greater than the few animals that we are actually able to recover, dead or alive.
David Mizujewski, he's a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation. Turning to you, Jeremy Jackson, people have begun seeing fish and marine mammals in surprisingly shallow water. What's going on there?
Well, I think as the habitat is being impacted, animals that have the capacity to move, move in any direction that if they have that kind of behavior, that may increase their chances of survival. Frankly, my interest in this is a little bit longer, more in the longer term, because I headed the study of a rather small oil spill in Panama about 25 years ago with a coastline very similar to the coastline of the Gulf. And what I saw was that the initial visible impact is just the beginning of a long story. And in the way I would characterize it is the spill I studied was only about 2 million gallons, about a fifth the volume of the Exxon Valdez. This spill could easily be 30 Exxon Valdezes in equivalent volume, so humongously greater. And yet that tiny spill in Panama killed the mangroves, the seagrasses, and the coral reefs along an entire 100-kilometer strip of the complex Caribbean coast of Panama. A lot of that oil is still offshore, but it's coming ashore. Mm. It's already come ashore in a lot of places. And that's something we know about. You know, the nature of the damage offshore is something that we're frankly, to a large degree, ignorant of in terms of how this oil will behave and what its impact will be on the food webs of the open ocean. But there's very little doubt about what happens when oil comes ashore. It's a catastrophe for anything living on the shore, and the nature of the impact increases with the complexity of the coast, the amount of marsh or seagrass, what have you. So if we had tried to imagine a coastline that would be the worst possible recipient of a spill of this nature, the northern Gulf Coast would be that coastline.
And of course, we're not necessarily going to see everything that has died.
No, and I mean, I guess I would say, who cries for the plankton? Who cries for the minnows? We see the birds, and they're incredibly important because we can relate to them, or to the mammals or the turtles, and so they engage us. But in terms of the way an ecosystem works, the stuff you can't see is every bit as important. It's the basis of the food chain upon which all those charismatic animals depend. And we're certainly drastically disrupting the food chain of the entire Northern Gulf.
Jeremy Jackson, he's director of the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And turning to you, Tom Moorman, what about the birds? Which species are at the greatest risk?
Well, what we face here is this, of course, occurred during summer, so we have the resident birds that are at immediate risk. And what we're seeing, of course, you've heard about the pelicans, various gulls, royal terns, sandwich terns. Most of these birds are what we would call beach nesting or island nesting birds. Of course, the barrier islands and beaches are the first thing to be impacted by landfalling oil. As we move into late summer and fall, we'll start to see the annual fall and winter migration of literally millions and millions of migratory birds, many of which use Louisiana coastal wetlands as either a staging area, where they'll stop over before heading further south, say down into Central America or South America, or they'll winter there by the millions. The first birds that we'll see migrating down will be Arctic nesting shorebirds starting in mid-July. And not all shorebirds are going to be equally vulnerable to oil because they have different habitat requirements. There's guilds of birds that will be stopping over or wintering directly on the beach. They will be very vulnerable to oil. These species would be things like piping plovers, which is an endangered bird. Endangered species such as the piping plover uses mudflats and beach foraging areas right on the Gulf all winter long. And so wherever oil impacts beaches and plovers happen to use those areas, they'll be at pretty high risk of mortality.
Tom Moorman, he's director of conservation planning for Ducks Unlimited. He's head of Ducks Unlimited Gulf Coast Response Team. When we come back, we'll talk about brown pelicans, other birds, other wildlife being affected.
Today at noon on the Kojo Namdi Show, 1 year after the fatal Red Line crash, we hear from Metro's official riders' representatives, plus too many specialists, not enough basic care. A new report says American medicine is failing to serve all of us. The Kojo Namdi Show, today at noon here on WAMU 88.5.
Next time on Tell Me More, we've told you about mystery man Alvin Green. Now, what about Tim Scott? If he wins a runoff on Tuesday and then the general election to take over a vacant seat, he could become the first black Republican to serve in Congress since J.C. Watts, his opponent only Strom Thurmond's son. More South Carolina politics next time on Tell Me More.
Join us for Tell Me More this afternoon at 2 here on WAMU 88.5. A code orange, air quality day, sunny skies, highs this afternoon in the low 90s with northwest winds around 5 miles an hour, 85 degrees at 10:20.
And we're back talking about the oil spill on the Gulf Coast, its effects on wildlife, and ultimately its effect on human life as well. On the line with us from Jackson, Mississippi, Tom Moorman, Director of Conservation Planning for Ducks Unlimited. Here in the studio, Jeremy Jackson. He's Director at the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And David Mizajewski, he's a naturalist for the National Wildlife Federation. I wanted to come back to you for a moment, Tom. The brown pelicans have become such a focus of attention. Talk about why.
Well, I think they're sort of iconic for the Gulf Coast. It's a species that was impacted decades ago by DDT. Agencies, especially the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries and Fish and Wildlife Service, made considerable effort to help the populations recover. And recently, they were removed from the endangered species list. The populations are doing quite well. Lots of birds nesting on barrier islands off the coast of Louisiana. They nest in colonies. And you know, they're just so iconic for the Gulf Coast. They're the bird you see perched on pilings and plunging into the Gulf to forage. And I think they are a good visual image of the wild and scenic nature of the Gulf Coast for all of us. So.
And, of course, what we've been seeing of late is the almost iconic image of these birds' feathers being cleaned. How would you assess that project, David?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, I visited at the Fort Jackson Wildlife Rescue Center where they're bringing the birds in Louisiana. And, you know, I was actually, I thought the operation looked pretty good. They seemed well organized. They are minimizing outside people coming in because that further stresses these animals, which you have to remember, don't know that we're trying to help them. And to be handled by a human is enormously stressful on top of the enormous stress that they're already going through from being covered in oil. But they, you know, again, they seem to have an efficient operation running as far as that goes. And my understanding is that there's about another 100 birds that are getting ready to be released, this time in Texas. The previous releases happened in Florida, but as the oil spreads and heads towards Florida, you know, people are realizing that's probably not the best spot because these birds just could be at further risk if they're released there.
Jeremy, what do you think of these rehabilitation efforts?
I think they're extremely important because they give us a sense of the damage that we have caused from the spill. I think that they highlight the immediate problem. I am not concerned about what we're doing, but perhaps what we're not thinking about yet in terms of the longer-term impacts. The Gulf of Mexico has been Exhibit A for disrupted ecosystems for other reasons for a very long time. There's something called the Dead Zone, which is an area about the size of New Jersey off of the mouth of the Mississippi. So very close to or overlapping with the area affected, definitely overlapping with the area affected by the spill. These are places where, because of nutrient pollution and a host of other problems, we see red tides, we see disruptions in fishery species, and now what we're going to see is a further disruption of all that by the input of this vast amount of organic material that will be broken down by bacteria, like all organic matter, and in the process that will use up oxygen, and it stands to make the dead zones a lot bigger and stands to make them last a lot longer, and dead zones kill things. And so this could be very bad for fish and shrimp.
Do you believe that the efforts to wash away the oil from these birds, these wildlife, is a fruitful effort? Do you believe that these birds will survive having gone through that kind of process?
You know, that I will admit that's a very rough question.
I know it's a rough question.
I believe, having David sitting next to me and as a expert on avian wildlife, that he obviously thinks these birds have a chance, or he wouldn't be speaking about this as a good effort. And I obviously trust that judgment. I think it does run the risk of distracting us from other kinds of problems. The amount of oil that gets into the marshes and the seagrass beds, how will we get it out? How great an effort are we prepared to make? This isn't something you can just do by a bulldozer. We're talking about an enormous human effort, manual labor, long-term thinking about restoration of the plants that provide the habitat for the birds and the turtles that we're concerned about for the future. We may save these birds, but if the marshes disappear, if the swamps disappear, if the seagrasses disappear, there won't be any place for those birds to live. And so while we do this, we have to also be thinking very, very hard about the next steps so that we don't just sit around and dawdle, but actually really focus on a response and recovery in the long term.
And before we get on to those marsh grasses, I just want to ask you, Tom Moorman, to what extent do you believe the cleaning, the washing, the painstaking effort to cleanse these beautiful creatures can be of help for them in the long term? Do you believe they'll survive the trauma?
Yes, I do. For the larger-bodied birds like brown pelicans, I believe the survival rate for those rehabilitated birds is actually very high. If they withstand the scrubbing process upon release, I believe I saw that survival rates are upwards of about 80%. But that's a large-bodied bird. If you take that down to something smaller, say a sandwich tern or something like that, I suspect for various reasons they'll be less tolerant. But nonetheless, it is clearly the right thing to do, and I think we have that responsibility to do it. I would like to underscore a point that Jeremy makes, however, that the real issue here, you know, when you're talking about rehabilitated birds, you're talking about individuals. The real issue here is conservation of populations. Populations depend upon habitat. Coastal Louisiana has lost over 1 million acres, or about 40% of its historic coastal wetland base. That was prior to the oil spill. The president called for a Gulf Coast restoration plan, and that is really ultimately what's needed here, is a long, long-term restoration effort to restore these coastal wetlands so that we don't have to worry about bird populations in the sense of losing individuals. And they can sustain the populations, but you have to have that habitat base in place. And that is really what needs to come out of all of this huge disaster, is a real strong commitment on behalf of all the people to restore coastal Louisiana and all the Gulf Coast wetlands that are critical to supporting life, not only for birds, but a lot of the other organisms that you heard Jeremy talk about all out in the Gulf depend upon those marshes for their nurseries.
Indeed. David, I know you advocate spending the time, the effort to cleanse these birds, and yet there have been voices speaking out saying that the birds should be euthanized. What is your thought?
Well, I'll just start by saying I agree with everything that Jeremy and Tom just said, that you know, it is an important thing that we try to rescue and clean and release these oiled animals. It's true that they're individuals, and sort of the unit of importance in you know, populations and ecologies is that population level. But and we can't underscore, or we can't forget the you know, that again, we're human beings, and a lot of people, and I've been hearing from a lot of people that have contacted National Wildlife Federation, that feel that it's our ethical obligation to try to help as many of these individual animals as possible. And just because it's hard doesn't mean we shouldn't try. With that said, absolutely, of critical importance is keeping the big picture in mind, because cleaning the birds is really the emergency room situation. And in those situations, we know that not everybody survives, right? We need to have restoration of the coastal Louisiana wetlands. That's critical for so many species. 90% of the species that live in the Gulf either, you know, rely on that coastal Louisiana wetland ecosystem for some stage of their life, or for their primary source of food. And that includes people, too. So much of our food comes out of the Gulf and directly out of these coastal Louisiana wetlands. You know, and then also in the big picture, you know, we're just going to keep having these problems unless we really get serious about clean energy and making that happen now rather than, you know, never.
You said you were down there in the Gulf. You saw the difference in those marsh grasses. What, within a few days' time?
I was down there all last week. I got down on Monday and immediately went out into Barataria Bay. And we spotted, you know, just a few miles off of the marina where we left, some oiled marsh grasses. And just, you know, a couple little spots. And the folks that I were with that lived down there, charter boat captains and such, were, you know, kind of shocked at that. When I went back out in that same area on Thursday of last week, it was, I mean, there was just so much more oil that had penetrated into that bay. And, you know, once it gets in there, it's, you know, there's so little that you can do. And it, you know, eventually will kill the marsh grasses, causing more erosion. As Tom was saying, this is an ecosystem that's already rapidly, you know, being lost to erosion and development and pollution. And this is just another, you know, major impact on there. So it's not a good scene. And you know, there are booms out. In some places, at Queen Bess Island, where they're nesting pelicans, there seem to be more oil on the inside of the boom than on the outside. So just heartbreaking to see these birds, spoonbills, pelicans, getting covered in this oil, and knowing that once it gets into those ecosystems, it's difficult or impossible to really get out.
Jeremy, what is the future of those ecosystems, especially the marsh grasses?
Well, I think that they will, any area that has been heavily oiled, if we can make a verb of it, will die. In my experience in Panama, whatever part of the mangroves or the marsh grass or the seagrass that was directly exposed to oil died. It was eventually possible with great labor to regenerate the mangrove by planting one by one new seedlings to replace the trees that had been killed. And now, 25 years later, although oil still leaks out of those mangroves from that spill, we can see recovery. So it is possible to respond and facilitate the restoration of the habitat, but it won't be up to par. Very possibly for decades.
And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You can join us, 800-433-8850. A number of our listeners have been asking about the autopsies of dolphins and whales. Do they show the deaths as being oil-related, David?
You know, I haven't seen any definitive reports yet. Last week, there was a sperm whale found about 70 miles south of the Deepwater Horizon. So we're talking, you know, pretty far out. And, you know, we have to be responsible, scientifically based when we make these claims about whether or not an animal died of one thing or another. And that's why we are waiting for the test results on the toxicology and the necropsies that are being done on these animals. You know, with that said, you know, we can't say for sure scientifically yet. I think that all of these animal deaths should be treated with suspicion.
All right. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Deborah, who's in Falls Church, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning. There's been talk about the few bird rehabilitation wildlife stations, but what about marine mammals like dolphins? Can anything be done? And second, have the experts noticed the lack of photographs of oiled birds on television and in newspapers? Most of the photographs you see are these happy pictures of birds that have been washed, at least relatively happy, and it's almost as though no one can bear to publish the truly horrific pictures of birds struggling with a quarter inch of oil all over them.
Of course, we have seen such photographs on the front pages of the New York Times, Washington Post. How do you respond, David?
Well, the sea turtles and the marine mammal rescue is being handled by the Audubon Nature Institute, along with Fish and Wildlife and a bunch of other groups. And there, you know, there are ways of rehabilitating turtles. I'm not 100% sure, as I mentioned earlier, about how they go about rehabilitating marine mammals. And so far, there have been so very few of them found alive of the ones that have been recovered. But I do think that there is an effort to keep some of these images out of the media. And I'll just share an example, again, from my trip down to coastal Louisiana last week, where so many of the charter boat fishermen are out of jobs now. And National Wildlife Federation, in part because we've had a long presence in coastal Louisiana working on restoration issues, you know, we're kind of there on the ground ready to, you know, hit the ground running as soon as this happened. And one of the only things we felt we could do was try to tell the story. So we've been chartering boats, taking out media, you know, photographers, everyone from the, you know, NBC Nightly News to the AP and Reuters and so on and so forth, again, to help tell this story. And that's becoming increasingly difficult because BP has been hiring up all of the charter boat captains and the quote-unquote vessels of opportunity. Again, this is all anecdote, but we're hearing stories from some of these folks, many of whom don't want to go on the record, that they're really being pressured not to take photos, not to take media. And you know, I don't want to be too conspiracy, you know, theory-minded here, but again, I think we have to approach this situation with some suspicion.
Jeremy, there's this balance between the oil producers and the protectors of wildlife. There's also, on the same side, the fishermen, and recognizing that they also have an interest in seeing the oil production continue.
There are a lot of different sides in the Gulf, and it's very, very complicated. From the point of view of the fishermen, their business has been threatened by many other factors for quite a while, and this is just a new threat on top of it.
Jeremy Jackson, director of the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. We'll take a short break. More of your thoughts when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Drilling through vast resources of shale for natural gas could be a step toward a new energy future. But new documentary highlights environmental and health concerns, rewards and risks of shale gas. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
Starting at noon, preparing doctors to serve the public, why top medical schools may be failing. Today, noon to 2 on The Kojo Namdi Show.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the German Embassy, inviting people to spot the Germany.info bus in Washington, D.C., or online. More information is at Germany.info, a web publication on politics, culture, and lifestyle.
This is Kojo Namdi, and even though I am called a talk show host, most of what I do is listen, because this station has a well-informed listenership. I would say the listeners are the ones who make this show a success.
The Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Weekdays at noon on WAMU 88.5.
And we'll go right back to the phones to Maddie, who's in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hi.
Me and my friends had a lemonade stand on Saturday, raising money for the animals affected by the oil spill.
Good for you.
What?
Good for you.
And we're wondering, if we want to come down to help, how can we do that?
David.
Hi, Maddie. First, let me say, you rock. We really appreciate everything that you're doing to help out the animals. Unfortunately, regular folks can't really go down and get involved in the cleanup of the wildlife, and that's for a couple of reasons. Number one, these are wild animals. You need some specific training on how to handle them so you don't hurt yourself or hurt the animals. And also, this oil is really bad stuff. It's toxic. It's poisonous to people as well as wildlife. So only very, very specialized people who get specialized training can go down and do that. Even I can't do that, and I handle wildlife on a regular basis. What you can do is get involved by making donations to any number of groups, including National Wildlife Federation. We've got some great ways that you can get involved. Just by making a contribution, you can get involved. If you're on Facebook or Twitter, you can follow us and help us spread the word. That's really important. And also for parents out there, National Wildlife Federation has some resources that I helped a little bit to develop on how to talk to your kids about this oil spill, because the images we are seeing are pretty graphic, and parents might need some help with that.
Maddie, I'm so glad you did the work you did with your friends. Thank you for your effort to help the situation. Keep up the good work.
I have one more thing. If we're going to send money in, how can we make it so we especially goes to the animals in the oil spill?
I can just speak for National Wildlife Federation, but any donation that we are getting is going to a Gulf Coast restoration fund that's specifically going to be used to help the wildlife and their ecosystem in the Gulf.
And Maddie, if you'll ask your mom, or if you will go up to our website, drshow.org, you'll find the websites of all the organizations who are on this program this morning: National Wildlife Federation, Ducks Unlimited, and Scripps Institution. Thank you so much for your call. You know, Jeremy Jackson, we're talking both about an economic disaster in human terms. We're also talking about an environmental disaster across this country, and perhaps if this problem gets into the Atlantic, you're talking about food for the world.
I think that we're really at a crossroads in our society today. We tend to look at events like this in terms of oil and energy versus fish. Where are the greater number of jobs? But that's a very short-sighted point of view, because all of these things are connected. The fishing industry of the Gulf is of great economic importance. It's also the consequence of maintaining a healthy ecosystem, something which is gravely threatened for reasons in addition to now this horrific oil spill. We are obsessed by oil, and we make bad choices. We go further and further offshore. We take greater and greater risks.
Without regulation.
Without regulation, and demonstrably without any kind of emergency plan. It's interesting, for example, that in the nation of Norway, a well in deep water cannot be opened up to pump oil until a relief well is already in place. What a concept. Have the insurance policy in place before you take the risk. So we are, we have a kind of an outlaw attitude about all of this. It's a cowboy mentality, and we need to rein that in. But more importantly, we have to recognize that there are better choices for energy, and we have to move in those directions, because otherwise we will continue to be blackmailed by this need for oil and risk-taking.
To Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Gary. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Your show is a national treasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I really like the point the guest just made as well, and to dovetail with a moment ago, I wonder if we're ever going to ever be able to measure the damage to the Gulf and the ocean that's occurring a mile below and way below the surface. Our usual attention is kept on the surface damage to surface animals that we know, and where the land meets the sea, marshes and coastline, but will we ever really know how devastated this body of water has become and the ecosystem below the surface?
Jeremy.
I think the answer to that is no. The oceanography, the basic scientific knowledge of these deep water ecosystems, is fairly limited. Where I work, there are a number of people who quite well-known people for whom this is their specialty, and they commonly talk about our ignorance of a lot of the basic aspects, because frankly, there hasn't been the investment in the kind of science that would be necessary to get that information. But there are indicators, and you can be sure that when the final tallies come in, the numbers of sharks, the numbers of whales, the numbers of dolphins that will be affected, what the abundance of sharks may or may not be, these aspects that are somewhat easier to observe will start to give us a clue of the magnitude of the damage. And I think we can move on from there. I don't like the notion of being compelled to have an exact tally. I'd rather see us move on to say, we know this is bad. We don't need to refine the obituary even further. We need to get on with our lives and do things better in the future. And that means being precautionary and thinking wisely about the ecosystems that we are stewarding and to behave accordingly.
Here's an email from an EPA scientist who says he helped develop methods to assess the risk to aquatic ecosystems from toxic chemicals. He says, I believe the underwater plumes of dispersed oil pose a significant long-term risk to the aquatic food chain in the Gulf. David?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to agree with that assessment. And one of the things that's so scary about this disaster is that we just don't know. As Jeremy was saying, number one, the base science isn't there. So this is happening, and we don't even really know what the original kind of circumstance is in terms of how this is going to have a long-term impact. And so we don't even know the extent of the oil under the water. I mean, there are people now just trying to get out there and get some footage of this and do some testing. And I mean, I've heard estimates of, you know, 20-mile long plumes that are three miles, you know, thick. And, you know, we see a sperm whale that washes up or is floating on the surface. And that's why I say we have to treat those instances as suspicious, because guess what? Those sperm whales are existing in that exact same habitat and, in fact, having their calves right now. So and to a point that Jeremy made earlier on, too, I mean, who knows what the impact on plankton is? That's the base of the food chain. So, you know, we might not ever know the exact, you know, mortality of all of the animals that are out there, but there are indicators, and, you know, we are going to see some of this big megafauna washing up. We're going to feel it when, you know, the people that live in the Gulf Coast can't go out and make their living anymore. Right. They're already feeling it. We're going to feel it when we can't get shrimp. A third of all the shrimp that we eat in this country comes from the Gulf of Mexico. So,
to East Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, Jeff.
Hello. Good to be on. I just have a quick question. One of your guests said earlier, how much effort are we willing to put into this cleanup? And I'm just wondering if they think that there's some sort of economic opportunity to create jobs out of this in the cleanup effort to maintain that sort of sustained effort in the cleanup.
Tom Mortman.
Well, I think we've already seen, unfortunately, a lot of people working on the cleanup, so it did create jobs that we probably really didn't want, but we've got them. I think in the sense of the long-term restoration, the answer is yes. I think that a lot of coastal restoration in Louisiana will require, strangely enough, lots of construction. Using the Mississippi River to introduce freshwater and sediment will require the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do lots of contractual work and hands-on kinds of construction. So I think the answer is yes. If we're committed to restoration, committed to total cleanup and total restoration of the system, absolutely, it could create jobs.
All right, to Bow, New Hampshire. Following up on that, Sue, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you. Yes, actually, it's a perfect follow-up to what was mentioned before about the freshwater restoration. I know a long-term problem has been the industrial canal that's prevented the wetlands from being even kept up, and the wetlands have retreated from 150 miles out to 25 miles out, and that's a long-term problem. And I'm wondering if there's, in terms of a long-term solution, maybe eliminating that industrial canal, letting the Mississippi River help in that restoration of the wetlands.
Jeremy.
Well, it's a lovely example of the conflict of different interests. We're in a catch-22 situation with the Mississippi, and if we really let the river flow, there's no doubt it will be good for the marshlands. There's considerable doubt about the implications for the future of New Orleans. So, I mean, this is an example to me of the kinds of very difficult decisions that will have to be made. Do we want to have healthy marshlands and coastal ecosystems for the future? And are we willing to make the kinds of hard decisions that will be necessary to achieve that? I hope the answer to that is yes, because I think in the long term, it will be to the greater economic as well as environmental benefit to do so.
And an email from Larry who asks, is anyone trying to save endangered species, including plants? Are they trying to collect them before they get into trouble? David.
I have heard nothing about plants in this whole conversation. And again, that's a great example of one of the sort of forgotten aspects of all this in terms of endangered species. And certainly, you know, plants can be endangered just as well as animals.
Absolutely.
Can. And it, you know, the immediate visual impact, you know, that we're seeing are the oil pelicans and such. So we can't forget about all the other species that are being impacted, whether they be plankton, you know, or sharks.
David Mishinewski, he's a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Ben in Jacksonville, Florida, good morning, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Diane. I was wondering, with the fishing industry and crabbing and oysters and the shrimp, you know, not being able to be taken from the Gulf in that area, where will that supply of shrimp and crabs and oysters come from, and how long would it take to actually be able to fish in those areas again?
It's a good question, Jeremy.
Well, where they'll come from is wherever the industry can scramble to find them, and you might want to think about the sourcing of the stuff you buy in the store in the future. How long will it be? A long time. It depends on how long that oil plus dispersant mixture maintains itself in the water column, the extent to which it gets incorporated in the plankton, which are, for example, the food for the oysters. You're not going to want to eat oysters that taste like oil. The same for shrimp. It might be only a few years. It could easily be a decade or more before the concentrations of oil are sufficiently low that the health authorities will allow that seafood to be marketed.
I'd be interested in your reactions to this final email from Laura in West Roxbury, who says, it boggles my mind how we can watch the suffering birds, turtles, and not rethink our rapacious and irresponsible destruction of our Earth. But we're not paying nearly enough attention to the deeper water destruction of life, both from the oil and the toxic dispersants we've heedlessly used. And I use the term we advisedly. BP is not the only responsible party. We choose our government. We choose our economic policies. Jeremy.
Well, all of us are indeed responsible. And we are clearly unwilling so far to make the kinds of sacrifices and changes in our way of life that will be necessary to decrease our dependence on oil. And the email is really to the point with regard to the issue of why do we use dispersants? We use dispersants because out of sight, out of mind. We're not really solving the problem. We're not cleaning anything up. It's just like having a greasy frying pan and cold water. You put a ton of dish soap in the pan to try and wash the grease down the drain. Because we don't want the stuff to be seen. And I don't know anything factually about whether or not an effort is being made to keep photographs that are disgusting out of the media or not, but out of sight is out of mind.
I would totally agree with that. And, you know, the reason they use them is because it keeps the oil from reaching shore. And part of the logic in that is that, you know, it's not going to have impact on the visible wildlife as much. But I think we've dumped an unprecedented amount of these chemicals into the Gulf with not any sense of what the long-term impact is going to be to the, you know, the Gulf ecosystem or even just the individual animals that are out there. And a sperm whale under the water might be less visible than pelicans on the shore. So, you know, somewhere in the line, I think that played into the rationale in using those chemical dispersants.
Well, we all wish we could disperse with this discussion. But we can't. It's going to go on for years and years. Thank you all so much. David Mizejewski of the National Wildlife Federation, Jeremy Jackson of the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation, and Tom Moorman of Ducks Unlimited. Their websites are all on ours. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, analyzing federal and state strategies for increasing broadband access at PewTrusts.org. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.